He rolls natural 20s on 12-sided dice. Reaper raised over $3 million in a Kickstarter to fund his Kickstarter. His mom lives in his basement. He is the most interesting gamer in the world.
I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I prefer Rule Zero. Game on, my friends.
From the Rule Zero studios in High Bar Zoom, this is Rule Zero, the podcast for gamers to talk about gaming. All games, all gaming, all the time. Welcome to the conversation.
Welcome back to Rule Zero. I'm Chris, and no power in the verse can stop me.
And I'm Pete, and no power in the prose can stop me?
That works.
Okay.
So we are back with another wonderful episode of Rule Zero.
Yay, verily.
And we are going to talk about some things that have been on our minds lately.
Indeed.
We are here to help.
That's what we'd like to do.
So let's talk about what we've been doing.
Helping handy.
We indeed.
Yes.
Let's talk about what we've been doing lately. I played a D&D Next game in Ravenloft.
Yay, do tell.
That's a lot of fun. It was actually a playtest for the packet that just came out.
What is
except we had some throwback character generation stuff from the previous packet, so it was kind of a mix. And
for those of us who don't know, what came out in the most recent packet?
In the most recent one, there are different builds and ways to build the characters with specialties and backgrounds and stuff, and that was in the previous one as well. But they just had different mechanics to them.
Fair enough. Okay.
So building your character now, you're kind of layering on these packages.
Gotcha.
So you take your class, you take your race, you have a background, you have a specialty.
Nice.
And then, you know, you build your feats. The feats are part of your specialty. So that's,
okay.
You know, and so this is all, this is stuff we can talk about now.
Nice. Yay. I like the fact that we can finally talk about this because I've been so chomping at the bit. It's not even funny.
Yeah, my impression is that it's coming along.
Okay, so give me... Sorry, go ahead.
Much more robust as far as creating a character.
Oh, nice. Okay. What I wanted to know, excuse me, and I have a definite kind of want to know this. When you say that you have, like, a character, like, sort of class, and then you have a specialty, and the feats are based on the specialty, could you have, like, a rogue con man kind of thing going on, or...
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that they're going for.
Okay.
They don't have, you know, every possible concept you could have, you know, statted out right now. But that's the kind of thing they're going for. In fact, you don't have to take... I mean, obviously there's some advantage to taking, you know, wizard with the magic user specialty. However, you could take a rogue with a magic user specialty.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And, you know, depending on how you had built other aspects of your character. And we were monkeying around with this a little bit with the... with the previous packet, and creating characters that were not built the way that the designer clearly expected.
Okay.
Because that's kind of what a playtest is for. You're supposed to break the game.
Right.
You know,
yeah, see what is
to see
breakable.
What's not working.
Yeah.
You know, it's like testing software. Your goal is to break it.
Right.
And things, you know, obviously there were classes and backgrounds and specialties that were meant to go together.
Okay. Give me an example, please.
From the previous example, well, there's the you know, the magic user specialty on the wizard class. That's an obvious pair.
Okay, gotcha.
But if you chose an elf as your race, you could cast a spell which lets you qualify for the magic user specialty, even if you weren't a spellcasting class.
Nice. Okay.
So I don't think that it puts you at too much of a disadvantage. You weren't destroying your character by taking something that wasn't optimized.
Gotcha. Okay.
I made up a character exactly the way that they seemed to expect it. I made up a dwarf cleric healer. And I also made up a character that was a elf fighter duelist. I mean, the duelist looked like it was meant to be a rogue class, but I chose it as a fighter class.
Oh, okay.
So... there are different ways you can build that up.
Right.
Or maybe it was the two-weapon fight. I don't know. One aspect of the fighting style was it looked like it was meant to be for rogues.
Okay.
But I built a Dexy fighter, so that was different.
Cool. Okay. Nifty.
And I was actually torn on, because I had taken an elf, I had a spell, and I was torn on whether to take the magic user ability, the magic user specialty.
Right.
I chose not to in the end, and, you know, life went on.
Right. You didn't feel that hurt you necessarily over much or whatever.
I didn't think it would have hurt me. There was the third level ability looked less useful.
Okay.
Because it was find familiar.
Ah.
And since I didn't have any spells that needed a familiar to cast or that would be advantageous to cast with a familiar, it seemed like it would be less of a good build, but it could still be done.
Right. Okay. Groovy.
So I'd be like a fighter with a talking weasel.
I've heard that about your weasel.
I mean,
I
like
just
you
wish
could,
it would
if
shut up,
that,
God.
You could build Beastmaster that way.
Yes. Oh yeah, easy.
So yeah. I mean, you could take the familiar, and you know, you could just have this animal familiar that you talk to, and it could
would
be like.
Would that be like Coden Poto or the eagle, or would it be the big black tiger?
It would have to be a small animal.
Oh, okay. So it'd have to be Coden Poto, the ferrets.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's actually alarming to me that you remember their names.
I have many alarming abilities, as I recall.
Yeah. So tell me about your gaming that you've done. You said you did a gloom game.
I got to do a gloom game. I got to our mutual friend Ron got a copy of Gloom Cthulhu,
mm-hmm.
which he brought over to the house, and we had a very nice dinner, and we played Gloom Cthulhu, and it's set up very similarly to traditional Gloom in that there are four families, but in this case, the four families all have to do with different stories from the Lovecraft mythos.
Nope.
So there was a group from Miskatonic University. There were the inbred family from I'm drawing a blank on the name of the story now.
Did you feel that you had to have known those stories?
You didn't have to know the stories, but it helps to, because I think it made it funnier. It seems to me like a lot of times when you play Gloom, if you get the inside joke that they're going for, it's a lot more entertaining.
Well, you know, I've never read the Cthulhu stories,
right.
But I've absorbed a lot of the mythos just from the culture of the gaming environment that I hang out in.
Yes.
And since I've never actually read the stories, do you think I would get it? Do you think I would appreciate Gloom?
I think you'd still have fun with it. I think you'd still have a lot of fun with it. One of the nice things about it is, because you know the general overarching basic concept of what the old ones are about and things like that. You know, mm-hmm. they're chaotic creatures from outside of time and space that have come into our world. And
I have read the Alan Moore graphic novel at the Neonomicon.
Oh, there you go. So, so there is that. So you just, you know, it's one of those things where you learn, if you know what the overall storyline is about, you can still get a lot out of it. And then some of the things that happen to you are kind of fun, you know, like, and if you know the mythos, then it's one of those fun things where it's like, oh, this one's from, you know, from the story from beyond, or this one's from, you know,
So there's kind of like Easter eggs if you have read the story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to have read the story.
No, because
it's
still a very strong Gloom game. The difference being with this one is that there aren't quite as many mundane things that they bring out to help do you in.
Okay.
So, like, what is it? Pestered by Poodles kind of goes along the wayside, you know, as in, you know, Hugged by Shoggoth or something like that comes up and things like that. So. But
so you play these cards and tell a story about them, and you just make your family more and more depressing.
You make them more and more depressing, and you do them in one by one. And the person who ends up with all five family members dead at the end with the basement number of points wins.
Do you need a special card to actually kill a family member?
There are many death cards.
Okay, I mean, do you need a card that says you may kill a family member to kill a family member?
Well, it just says this is a death card. It's got the Reaper, the Grim Reaper, on it.
Okay.
And it usually has, like, how they could have died, you know, but the agency of demise. So, you know, run onto the railroad tracks or something like that, you know, as a way to pull them off. And then you have to tell the story of how they got there and why that killed them.
How would you compare this set to the previous Gloom installments?
Very similar. I just, like I said, I think it's a, I like the, because I am a big Cthulhu fan and I have read the Cthulhu stories, And I've played Call of Cthulhu. I really feel that it was very entertaining for me to play.
Excellent. So, okay.
I would recommend it. I would recommend Gloom in general, but I think Cthulhu Gloom has a fun supernatural gibbering horror feel to it that
excellent.
Don't.
Well, okay. Why don't we talk about some news?
Okay, sure.
It is time for the news.
In the news this episode, the Marvel Heroic role-playing game has come out with a Civil War book, and there look to be a bunch more Civil War supplements coming out.
I'm very excited about that.
I have played a couple sessions now.
And I have,
once run by Dave, and Eric ran a session.
I have yet to play it, but I'm looking forward to playing it at some point.
Maybe I will bring it up for Thanksgiving, and I will run it for you.
Oh, that would be lovely.
Wouldn't it? Eric made a campaign, made a little story, and he urged us to make up Next Generation Heroes. And so somebody had Tony Stark's daughter.
All right. Oh, so Avengers Next.
Yeah. Kind of. Cool. So she was Iron Maiden.
Nice.
And I made up a character called Artillery, who is the son of Cannonball.
Oh, fun.
I had my concept was he was the son of Cannonball and Boom Boom.
Oh, that's fun.
Tabitha.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are obviously non-canon characters. But it was like we were theorizing a next generation of them. So you know how Cannonball has the power to fly into things, basically.
Right, he's invulnerable as long as he is flying.
Right, I'm pretty near invulnerable as long as I'm blasting.
Mm-hmm.
And Tabitha had...
It concerns me that you can quote that.
Do you know how much New Mutants I read? That was one of my favorite titles.
Now I know. And Tabitha had the ability to shoot off these little sparks that go boom, 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 and blow up shit.
Right.
Yes, stuff.
So I made Artillery... So I made up Artillery as he has the power to fly into things and explode.
Oh.
It's a combination
of... Do that trick once?
Yeah, one fight.
I'd like to, but I can only do the trick once.
No, so he kind of has Cannonball's powers, but he can also explode his aura, his energy aura, which depowers him for a time.
Right, which makes sense.
So it's an area attack, but it leaves him defenseless for a bit.
Right. Which is good.
So that was my idea for him. So unfortunately, there were no versions of Cannonball statted up, so I had to kind of make up my own. And I got a little help from Dave, who sent me a version that somebody else had statted up.
Okay.
That it's completely non-official. So.
Gotcha.
But the Civil War event has a lot of different supergroups getting their own supplement.
Yep.
So there's a 50 States Initiative coming out. There's a Young Avengers Runaways supplement
very
coming
exciting.
Out. There's an X-Men supplement coming out.
Oh, very exciting.
So I expect to see some of the characters that I want to see, mm-hmm. you know, statted out in some of these books.
Yep. I'm also looking forward to the upcoming Annihilation books as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This looks like some of these, the cosmic heroes are going to be here.
I love the Marvel Cosmic Line too, and I've always felt kind of, well, I felt cheated twice because I'm not sure that I'm keen on the new Bendis Guardians of the Galaxy, rather. Warren Ellis was doing such a good job, like, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
And
there are certain writers that handle these cosmic scale heroes in ways that kind of humanize them and also make them interesting as cosmic forces.
Yes.
And I'm not sure Bendis is one of them.
I'm not sure that he's up for that task, really. I'm just hoping that the spirit of Annihilation and then Annihilation Conquest remains, you know, in the game supplements, because I really enjoyed those series. And I would be interested in playing characters from those series.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So. Yeah, I always love those characters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Marvel. And
nice.
That's a lot to look forward to from Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
I was under the impression that they had a license for 16 books.
Wow.
And I think what I'm looking at here is more than 16 books. So I'm not sure if Annihilation is going to be one of the last products they have.
Well, I
kind of hope not, because I'm enjoying seeing, you know, more products released.
I'm thinking that what they're going to do is they're going to do a premium book mm-hmm. of each thing. Like, there's going to be a Civil War premium book and an Annihilation premium book. And then there are going to be the smaller books that come off of that that are included in the premium book, or you can buy them for cheaper.
No, that could well be. I don't know. Because these are much smaller books, these individual team books. These are much smaller.
Right.
So I'm wondering if those are only, if those are subsets. Yeah, so I guess that, that remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Civil War book is out. The event, the premium book, which has the core rules that you will find in the original Marvel Heroic role-playing book. Mm-hmm. Or you can get the Essentials, which just has the new stuff for the Civil War campaign.
Nice.
Or the Civil War story.
Nice.
So if you already own the original book, you don't need the deluxe one.
The premium book.
The premium, yeah. Right. Also, there's a new playtest for D&D Next out. If you have an account at Wizards of the Coast,
okay,
you are able to download. You're not allowed to distribute, but you can talk about it, and that's what I'm going to do.
Hey, you know what? I've got an account at Wizards of the Coast.
Right, so you can download the playtest.
I also have a Bloodcake smock and a trench out back. No, wait, what I meant to say was...
As long as you have a place to keep the bodies.
Of course I do. Don't be silly.
Have you downloaded the playtest?
I have not downloaded the playtest because, unfortunately, I do not have many people to play with where I am at this moment in time.
That is a sad tale you have told me.
It is.
This one comes with Caves of Chaos and the Isle of Dread. So we're talking, you know, some classic stuff going on
here. No kidding. I'm sorry they didn't call it Keep on the Borderland.
Well, the Caves of Chaos is from the Keep on the Borderlands.
Right, exactly.
This does not include the Keep in it.
No, but the Keep on the Borderlands was, and Caves of Chaos and Isle of Dread were all set within that same world.
Yeah.
So that's where the Karamikos and Red Steel eventually came out of.
Oh, was that part of the same campaign world?
Yep.
I was not aware of that. I knew that they had tied it into something, but I did not know what.
Yes.
So, yeah, it also comes with another adventure called Reclaiming Blingdenstone.
Ah, Blingdenstone.
Ah, how we hardly knew you.
Indeed. It's about time we reclaim that.
I'm not sure where this is from, if this is from an older adventure or if this is something they just made up using the new rule set.
Gotcha.
But there's three adventures in the download.
Right. Okay.
This is actually quite lengthy. This is a 40-page adventure.
But
it's got a bestiary, it's got character creation rules, and this playtest goes up to 10.
Ooh.
Not 11.
Damn.
But yeah, it's got it's got several different builds. It's slightly different creation system than the previous playtest packet. So, I mean, your older characters probably won't translate to this playtest, but that's not really the point of playtests, you know?
Exactly. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, the idea, right. Like you and I were talking
the idea
before.
Is to make up a new character.
Just to make up a new one and see if you can break the system. So,
yeah.
How can I break the system?
If it's got rules, I can break it.
Indeed. By golly, that's what we do. And is it pronounced bestiary or bestiary?
I have always said bestiary ever since I learned how to read English.
I see. Do you also pronounce it Inui?
You know, it all depends on where you put the emphasis,
okay.
And it's completely...
So you wouldn't call it...
It's completely your prerogative.
It totally is.
So, bite me. No, it says B-E-S-T, bestiary. It doesn't say B-E-A-S-T, bestiary. So, there's you know, plenty of ways you can run this playtest. You can what we did was the DM Mike pulled out the original Ravenloft adventure and we ran through that. That was a lot of fun.
Fun.
Which inspired a tweet, which if you follow us on Twitter, you will see.
Excellent.
So that's an Easter egg I'm going to leave there for
nice
people.
Easter egg on that one. And if you go to our website rulezeropodcast.com, you might be able to see in the sidebar some of those.
Yes, it may well still be there.
Yep.
Yes.
According to the online dictionary, it is in fact pronounced bestiary.
So there.
Suck it, Trebek.
All right. So anyway,
I
promised no Connery.
Mm-hmm. Good, because you're the Michael Caine. I'm the Connery. Okay. Let's just make that straight.
There's three pots to every trick. Anyway. So that's the news. I have Civil War. I have D&D Next. Do you have any news?
I do not.
So let us move into the main discussion for the evening.
Yes.
This is the heart of the matter.
Oh, Pete.
Oh,
let me tell you something.
Tell me.
I told you that I ran my Pathfinder game this past week.
Yes.
A couple weeks. Yeah.
Yes,
since
yes.
The last show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel terrible.
Did it suck balls?
Well, no, it didn't suck. Does many things.
Does that get us the tag again?
Oh, don't worry about that.
Okay.
It didn't suck much at all.
Okay.
In fact, it went really well, but I just didn't do it right. I failed at Pathfinder.
I didn't realize that Pathfinder had a grading system. How did you fail?
I lost. I cheated at Pathfinder.
So you fudged a bunch of die rolls and they all died horribly. You had a TPK?
No, I didn't fudge anything at all. I ran this game.
Yeah.
And I kind of had some ideas about what the party was facing.
Okay.
But I really, oh man, this, I cheated.
Okay.
I didn't have anything written down.
And that's bad because of why?
Well, isn't that, that's cheating the players, right?
No, why is that, wait. Okay, so the players had a good time.
Oh yeah, a couple of them felt it was like the best game that I ever ran.
And they felt threatened by this antagonist or the antagonists, as the case may be.
Yeah, I mean they were like really involved with the story and they were really trying to get down to figure out what was going on and everybody at the table was like sitting up straight, really engaged. We played for 4 solid hours and not a single person lost attention or focus.
Well, then how is that cheating? That sounds to me like what should happen at a Pathfinder game.
No.
Shouldn't it?
I didn't have the monster written down. I didn't have the stat for the monster.
Chris,
I cheated.
Chris, we have people who can help you now. We like to call ourselves Rule Zero. We're here to break you from this guilt and shame that you feel.
Pete, how can Rule Zero help me?
Well, it's very simple. We can help you by telling you that now that you're a grown-up, you don't need to stat out everything. It's not necessary.
I understand the words individually, but in that order, I'm just... nothing.
It seems odd to me. I think the biggest problem that we've had pretty much from the get-go is the ingrained belief that everything has to be pre-made well in advance, that if you don't do so, you're a organized and sloppy GM, and I don't think that's the case at all, especially since, you know, you have excellent evidence as to why that isn't the case. You know, you're perfectly in the zone there.
Yeah, normally I have things written down, but I had a really strong idea that I wanted to play with them.
Mm-hmm.
As, okay, I'm running an adventure path.
Right.
Which is Canned Adventures.
Right.
See episode 4.
Right.
And,
Canary Row.
Canary Row. Still available on RuleZero.com.
Yes.
Sorry, RuleZeroPodcast.com. Don't go to RuleZero.com. You'll get a vitamin supplement.
Exactly.
But I was running this Canned Adventure, and according to the next module, they finished one module, and according to the next one, they should have been 5th level before beginning it, and they weren't.
Right, I remember when we talked about this.
Yeah, so I had this idea to do an interlude adventure, and I just had some vague ideas about what I wanted to do. Basically, I wanted to somehow tie it into the players themselves, because there's not a lot in an adventure path to tie into the players.
Oh, right, because it's a canned adventure.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are traits which let the players tie themselves into the adventure that's going on.
Now you're just getting kinky.
There's not much printed in the modules that say or that address actual player goals or secrets or any or histories or anything like that.
Relationships,
exactly. I decided that I wanted to tie a player character history into the interlude.
Which is fantastic. That's a great idea.
And I also wanted to keep it thematic, which the adventure is kind of about wish magic, so I used a kind of genie, but I had to invent my own, because there wasn't a genie in the game that did what I really wanted to do here.
Okay.
So I had this basic premise in my head that they were going to go to Onyx Hall, which is in the Legacy of Fire campaign adventure path, as a dot on the map which has a paragraph written about it.
Was this the first adventure path that they went on?
This is the first time I've done an adventure path.
Right, but what I'm saying is that it related to the first adventure path they went on. Your interlude linked back because of this place that was in the first adventure path.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the adventure path, the word adventure path refers to the 1 to 16 level.
Oh, okay. You know. So
it's a six installment,
gotcha.
Six module story that is collectively referred to as
an adventure path. Okay. So the first module linked into your interlude, and that in turn is linking into the second module of the overall adventure path.
In a way, yeah. I mean, I'm linking into the theme without linking into any plot elements.
Oh, okay.
There's a map that's very vaguely described in the second module, and it says, here's a bunch of things that are around the city that they finished up in the last adventure.
Okay.
And they're just dots on the map. Each one of them has maybe a paragraph or two.
Oh, okay.
So I decided I would make an adventure around this one paragraph dot on the map.
I love doing that.
Called Onyx Hall.
Fantastic.
So, which the premise was there was a cursed mansion. So I had a couple things in mind. First of all, they thought cursed mansion. Okay, we're going to go fight undead. So one of my preconditions for making this adventure was that it wouldn't be undead.
Oh, good.
Because that just seems too obvious.
Yeah, I mean that's what everybody's expecting.
Right. So I mean, you hear cursed mansion, you think haunted house, you think bring a cleric and everything will be fine.
Or I think Fall of the House of Usher and everybody in the mansion's going to die, with the exception of you because you're the observer of this horrendous, horrendous thing.
Right. I think there was a basic D&D module that was based on the House of Usher.
You may be correct.
And I can't remember which one. It might have. I think it was one of the X's, but I'm not. We're talking like 1982 here.
I'm going to believe you.
Okay.
Okay.
I decided that I would not do undead because that was too obvious. The other thing is that it was about a curse, and the curse was that this family that was slavers will live in servitude until the stones themselves burn like a pyre. Those are the words of the module. And so, well, you think stones themselves burning like a pyre. You think volcanic eruption. Okay, so I decide, well, that's what I'm not going to do then.
Good.
So my premise was that they would travel to the Onyx Hall, which was a day's travel away from the city that they were in.
Right.
That they would then proceed toward the manor house, and then they were going to wake up, not having remembered where they were, and suddenly they have in their possession several objects, which they didn't have before.
Oh, fun, it's a memento.
Yeah, it's... Well, I actually explained this, my setup, to Eric, and he goes, hey, I think there was a Star Trek Next Generation episode like this. And
oh,
I said,
was.
Man, there was...
Yep.
Every single Star Trek Next Generation episode was like this.
No, that's not true. Just most of them were. That's true. Yes, with people waking up in unusual circumstances. My most memorable one being Troy waking up as a Romulan.
No, I don't remember that one, but I remember Data's dream was one that stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a cellular peptide cake with mint frosting.
Which is important.
Yeah, and there was one that I think they woke up and realized it was 3 days later.
Yes, and they suddenly have a new officer on board.
And there was one where Data knew what had happened, and he had promised earlier not to tell. Anyway,
I remember all those, yeah.
So anyway, these things were like kind of in my mind, and I said, well, how would you run a D&D game where the players didn't remember? Well, you would just have them wake up and not know how they got these things.
Yeah, you and I talked about that, actually.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we talked about it in podcast, but I think we talked about it.
I don't think we did.
Yeah.
So I had this idea to start them out that way, and whatever happened in the module, in the session, they would slowly figure out where these objects came from.
Gotcha.
And the objects themselves were supposed to be clues as to what they should look at next.
Oh, great.
So there was a carpet, an oil lamp, brass oil lamp, like, you know, an Aladdin.
Oh, gotcha. Thing. Okay.
A picture that had been removed from a frame.
No,
I'm sorry. They had a picture frame.
Oh, but no picture.
But no, with nothing in it,
okay.
Right? And a golden goblet.
Oh, okay.
So then they did the same kind of thing that most adventurers who realize they're playing a D&D-like game will do, which is basically try to methodically
figure out
examine
what they are.
And that's what happens.
How strong am I? Can I lift this?
No, they knew who they were.
Oh, okay.
They didn't lose their memory. They just lost their memory of what had happened and how they got there, waking up in the morning several days after they had gone in.
Gotcha. It was a Richard thing.
So, yeah. So I decided this was wish magic that was going on, and that's really all I had decided.
Which is fine, because wish magic gives you a lot of wiggle room.
Yeah, and so that's kind of where I went with it. And I had them go into the manor house, explore everything as if it were for the first time, because for the players it was, even though for the characters they had been there before.
Right.
And a lot of it was improv, and I had to, you know, I was going off every single person in the party. Like, I had an idea of what had happened. I knew what had happened. Mm-hmm. But I had no idea how they would go about finding out what had happened.
Which is fantastic. Plus, that completely takes out any possible metagaming.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's fantastic.
And, my other goal for setting up this adventure was that it would take exactly one session.
Oh, fantastic. I love that. That's great, Chris. God.
Because I didn't want to have... I felt it would break the mood if they were to leave and come back.
Okay, fair enough.
So I said, okay, my two goals to this is we are going to finish this in one night, mm-hmm. and I'm going to set it up where they don't know what happened. They have these objects. So they, you know, they went into the place, and they did it, and I had a couple conditions. There were the stones burning like a pyre. I actually had two ending conditions, like one if they do the right thing and one if they don't.
Right, okay.
Well, there was no right thing, but one if they... it was basically absolving the slaver family for having suffered, you know, after they've suffered for years.
Okay.
So one if they absolve the family, and another outcome if they don't, but either way it would end this curse.
Okay. Okay.
Because the way I tied it into the module, the adventure path, right. was that one of the characters was related to the person who had cast in the first place.
Nice.
So he had just been freed as a reward for freeing the city in the first module.
Okay.
For retaking the city in the first module. So he had earned his freedom, and that was one of the traits that he took. He had been born a slave and had been a slave all his life, and he earned his freedom by doing this first adventure.
Very cool.
So I decided he was descended from the witch who was enslaved, who cast the curse in the first place.
That's really a nice spin. I like it.
And so the way the curse revolved is that the curse would last until the last of the witch's descendants was freed from slavery.
Oh, okay.
And I decided that was him. So after 200 years of his ancestors being slaves, born to slaves, he was the last one still in slavery. So that was my precondition, is that he is the last person in this line.
Right.
And so basically it was down to him forgiving the family or not. Yeah, he did. Which I felt was a little too easy on his part, because one of the other players suggested, oh, well, just forgive him. And he goes, okay, I forgive you. I was like, okay, well, I kind of tried to... I had them find the library, and in the library was... every single book was the life of every single slave.
Wow.
Which carried in detail every single suffering and indignity of that person's life as a slave.
I like that as part of the curse. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and so they found the library, and they found all these things. But, he still seemed a little bit too easily forgiving, you know.
Well, he's high on liberty, you know. He's never had this kind of liberty before. Gives him this feeling, you know, of joie de vivre, and before you know it, he's freeing everybody.
Right, but I had, you know, so he freed the slaves, and this genie that was what I called a curse binder.
Okay, that's fun.
Could you not
have made him like something like an Ifrit or any other sort of supernatural being? Are there specific...
Well, the reason why I didn't is because all of those creatures have very narrowly defined abilities.
Okay, I wasn't sure. I haven't read any of the Pathfinder bestiaries, as we've established the pronunciation.
Right.
So I wasn't sure. But yeah, I mean, I think that's great. I think the concept that there's a creator out there called a Curse Binder is perfectly marvelous, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, this was something that didn't exist, and I wanted these particular abilities, and in particular, the ability to bind other people with a Geass and then have total control over them.
Oh, that's cool.
So when they went into the manor, every single adventurer who had tried to discover the secrets of this manor was still there.
Oh, that's cool.
And so they were
all... That's a lot of fun.
When they went in the door, it was like, you're welcome, you must go to the ballroom where the party is happening. And so the staff of the house were the twisted and tortured descendants, or the family members of the slaver family.
Okay.
Who were living in servitude.
Nice.
So they were regularly tortured, and you know, they were deformed, and you know, they could not die.
That's fantastic. I love that.
So these are ideas that I just kind of had in my head that I didn't really have written down.
That's okay. I mean, it worked, right?
Yeah, and so a couple people after the game said that was the best session you ever ran.
I think part of it might have been the fact that you weren't burdened by the prep.
It could well be. It's more like I wasn't burdened by having to follow these sets of abilities.
I have
one of the
please.
Oh, go ahead. No, please.
I was going to say I have three basic kind of GM craft questions for you from what you've just told me.
Okay.
My first one is, did you take notes of these ideas as they came to fruition? So you had it in front of you to reference back, so that there was some consistency.
I didn't contradict anything.
Okay.
But I was pretty careful that they only met the bad guy in three different encounters.
Okay.
They met the Curse Binder like three different encounters, and I had intended them to be brief encounters.
Okay, that's fantastic. The second question that I have, GMcraft wise, is there because we began this discussion by you feeling that you had cheated somehow the system.
Yes.
Is there canon within Pathfinder that states that there has to be, you know, that kind of prep ahead of time, that things should be statted out, or?
Ah, well, it's interesting that you should say that, because I feel that a lot of when I run Pathfinder, I want to run, or when I play Pathfinder, right, I want to feel that I have created a character that is built to survive in a world that is well defined.
Okay, I guess.
And you know, maybe that's not exactly the right phrase that I'm looking for, but what I'm looking for is, I know Pathfinder works a particular way.
Right.
And when I build a character, I have ideas about cool things that I want to try in the game.
Okay.
And if I try these cool things and they work, but I find out later that the GM just told me they worked and he didn't actually roll any dice, I would feel that that was kind of cheap.
Okay. Did you do something like along those lines in your game?
No, but I can. But because this creature had, I mean, I knew how many hit points it had. And I knew what its armor class was.
Okay.
And with those two things, I mean, I kind of had a combatable monster.
Yes. Yes, you did.
And I knew it had scimitars, and that it did X number of damage.
Right.
So, I mean, that was really all I needed for the two encounters they had before the big finish.
I think that's really all you need anyway, unless there is more of a backstory for them, in which case you can't use reference material anyway. You know, that's what you do. You create the bad guy, which is what we discussed in the last
episode. And I had said in that same episode that I only vaguely statted the bad guy out before it actually mattered.
And it worked.
Yeah, but in this case, I statted out less than usual. Like, in the example that I was speaking about earlier, I statted the bad guy out the encounter, you know, the a couple sessions before they actually ran into him.
Okay.
Whereas in this one, I actually statted the creature out after the game based on what I had it do.
Okay. I mean, that's not a big deal to me, because I've been, for many years now, I've been following the rule of say yes or roll the dice.
Uh-huh.
You know? So if it's, I think you and I talked about this you and I have spoken about this before, but not in cast, about the fact that there are certain times when you're playing a fantasy RPG, and there are those DMs who will make you roll everything.
Right. You know?
But to me, it seems like the most important rolls come when it's important to the overall storyline.
Right, right.
And so it struck me that that's what you were following in this game.
I was, and I guess as a kind of departure from the regular adventure path, I kind of forgive myself a little bit, but I still feel like I did not actually honor a contract with certain players. And some of my players really wouldn't care, but I know that at least one of them would.
But
fortunately, he doesn't listen to the podcast.
But did he have fun with that game?
I believe he did.
Then I don't think you broke any contract. I think the only contract that you have with your players is that when everybody sits down, when everybody stands up from the table, everybody had a good time.
Okay.
You know, I mean,
well,
that's...
let me give you an a more extreme example. Okay.
Okay.
You make up a character because you know that this spell combined with this feat make you a really good spell feat caster person.
Okay.
And I let you get into it. It's a class I made up, okay?
Fair enough. Spellfeed caster.
It's my game.
It's your world. We only play in it.
Exactly. So I, as the GM, allow you to make up this character, and then I bring you into a game, and I have you fight a kobold. And you try your spell, and you try your feat, and I don't even roll dice behind the table. I just tell you it doesn't work. Well, wouldn't you feel, like, kind of cheated? That I wasn't following the rules?
Yeah, but like I said, the only overarching rule besides Rule Zero, which is to have fun, for me, yeah. Rule One is say yes or roll the dice. You can't just come out and tell me that it fails, you know, unless there is some form of available arbitration. You know, conversely, you could have said, oh, he's one crispy kobold.
Uh-huh.
It smells like burning lizard for the next 15 yards. Or something like that. That's okay by me because kobolds are minor threats.
Uh-huh.
You know.
And also in the last game, I hand waved the pursuit and capture and killing of the last two gnolls in a giant gnoll combat, because it just wasn't worth the time to roll the dice when it was a foregone conclusion.
Which isn't a bad thing. You know, I think the more exciting thing is the final combat. It's them catching up.
Right. And that's the thing. I didn't feel bad about that at all, even though I didn't roll dice, you know.
Well, again,
I just said it just happens.
Like I said, I don't think rolling the dice all the time is a necessary function of the game.
Right.
You know, and I think you very nicely prove that in the you know, pursuit and evade portion of the module, and then again in your homebrew, you know, in your one shot.
Right.
And I think that's wonderful. I think you're not just, I mean, you and I talk theory until we're blue in the face, not just on the podcast, but you and I have talked for literally hours on the phone face to face. About craft, about Dungeon Mastercraft or GM craft.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we've gone, when you present me with this, I don't consider that to be cheating or a breach of contract or failure, you failing Pathfinder at all. I think, if anything, that's a huge success. I think you deserve kudos for that. You don't deserve an F, you deserve an A+.
Well, I'll tell you, I did feel good after the game. I felt that was one of the most interesting and enjoyable sessions that I'd run in a long time, and a couple people agreed.
Which is the whole point of the game.
It is the whole point of the game.
You know?
But at the same time, there was a part of me after the game that kind of could see the other side of the argument, which is, well, if you're just going to say this happens and that happens, why do we have why do we have character sheets and why do we have dice?
Because it's a matter of building tension. You know, as the GM, part of the good craft is knowing where to pull out the dice to help create the tension. And allow the people to be awesome. You know, we don't play heroes to purchase grain and have accounting. We play heroes to do awesome stuff, even if it means us dying in the interim. You know, even if it means us becoming horribly wounded or whatever. You know, that's why we become heroic creatures. You know, that's why we take on these fantasy mantles. Mm-hmm. It isn't so that we can be the bartender at the Green Dragon. It's so that we can be Frodo and Samwise and Pippin and Merry, you know, or we can be Aragorn or we can be Legolas.
Mm-hmm. I also notice a trend that there are a lot more games that are doing a very fast and loose mechanic,
mm-hmm.
as far as like not having things written down in such rigid terms.
I think part of it was the fact that sometimes you just get bogged down in matrices or in, yeah. or in, you know, the math of the situation, which,
sure.
you know, considering that if we hadn't had those games initially to act as a springboard and to build on, I don't think that the fast and loose stuff would be as good as it is, mm-hmm. or potentially as good as it is.
Right.
But, and you know, I also think that, you know, again, you have to be able to, a good game allows leeway.
Right. You know? Well, I also gave this thing impossibly tough powers mm-hmm. that I didn't feel bad about granting to it because they were kind of bottled.
Right.
You know, there was like, I knew that I was going to use them for this, but if I were to stat out a creature that could do these things, mm-hmm. you know, there's massive room for abuse.
Oh, yeah.
Like, a GM could run this character at the challenge rating that I gave to it, and it would be a party kill. Because there's, you know, there's so many ways this could just destroy a party. But because I knew that it was going to use these abilities in these particular ways, I felt safer doing that. I felt safer saying, okay, it can take one of the people that it has geased before, one of the NPCs, one of the adventurers that had come to the manor house before, and it could punish that NPC by turning her into sand, which is what happened, which is actually why the players decided, okay, we are going to take this bitch down.
Right, and I think that's wonderful, because one of the great things about it is that the Cursebinder isn't like going hither and yon across the countryside, wreaking havoc and turning people into sand pell-mell. It is in a specific location where it was summoned by a witch's curse to be, and it's doing horrible things in that situation. And that's great, you know, because yeah. you could have abused the heck out of it, and it could have just gone whoop up the chimney and been gone,
mm-hmm.
but it can't. And that's a great Achilles heel. That's one of those great weaknesses that I was talking about before, about, you know, what makes a strong villain, what makes a memorable villain. And one of the great things about it is that it's got, you know, it's to quote a Disney movie, it's got phenomenal cosmic power, but an itty-bitty living span.
Yeah, that's what this had. And yeah. thematically, a genie was good. Yeah. But the genie... I had to decide why the genie would want to keep the party from finishing this curse off. Mm-hmm. And I decided, well, she just had a good thing going.
It lets her be the prime material plan. It puts her on the top of the heap at all times. Right. You know, it's a great right. position to be in.
Right. So basically, I guess the undercurrent is that she's deriving some pleasure from having a couple hundred people in her house at her beck and call that she could kill with a thought that can't leave the house. So there's some kind of, what is she getting out of that? Well, you could go lots of different places with that.
Oh, you can. You totally can. That's great. And like I said,
depending on the maturity level of your group.
She's a memorable villain as a result.
Yeah, and they hated her instantly. Well, not instantly. She did turn a person into sand first.
Which is fantastic. You know, I mean, what a great evil thing to do.
Yeah, and the person got turned into sand because she gave some hint of what was going on.
Ah, see? You should never put that away. That's going to be the same every time.
So she somehow knew and came into the room and said, "You didn't tell anything that would worry them, did you?" And the person just started crying. And one of my characters grabbed hold of the NPC and said, "I'll protect you." And then she turned to stone and then crumbled into sand. And the party was like, "Oh, we are going to hurt this woman bad."
Nice. Very nice. Fantastic. I love it. That's great.
So that got them involved.
Right. Oh, no. I mean, that's a...
But, you know...
What a phenomenal hook.
What does that? Nothing does that. Nothing in the system does that. I made that up. It came out of nowhere.
That's... Which is great. You know, I think that's also another part that we have to... As GMs, we have to be careful about is the fact that, you know, how many times can I bring in a Sphinx?
Right.
You know? And things like that, because ultimately everybody's, oh, another freaking riddle, God, you know, stuff like that. It's there are just tropes so many tropes from the game.
Right.
But if you don't put a spin on it, one of the nice things, do you remember during the early days of D20, they came with a bunch of supplement settings and one of them was called Midnight?
Oh yeah, I love that one.
Yeah. My friend Judd ran that, and the way that he kind of did a different spin on things was he would take an animal, or he'd take a monster, and he would make it the only existing monster of that kind. So there was
that's great. I mean, that's because that's what a lot of the monsters in the in D&D were. There weren't minotaurs. There was the minotaur,
right? And like he also had the manticore,
right?
The griffin and things like that. So.
Right. I mean, Pegasus was not a race of horses. It was a horse.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's a good way to handle stuff like that. And a party is only going to see a certain number of each individual type of creature throughout its adventuring career anyway.
That's true. Very true.
How many dragons has any individual one of your characters fought?
Yeah, good point.
So, maybe there's the red dragon.
Right, exactly.
So in preparation for the game, I actually spent a lot of time working on the plot points and almost no time working on the stats.
Which is the way I usually do things, honestly.
I had conversations with you. I had conversations with Eric. I had, I just dwelt on like how to set it up and how to go about executing this idea for a one shot. And I think it went off well, but I still have that feeling of, should I have written these abilities down?
No. Why? what good? Okay. At this point in time, since it's already passed, what good is it going to do you?
Right.
But the crux of it is that during the game and even just before and even just after, everybody enjoyed it. You had fun.
Yes.
They had fun. You threw in things that they weren't expecting. I mean, it's great having her turn to stone and then crumble to sand. God, how wonderful. What a shocker for the party. They're not expecting that.
I hope
they also were. They also were going in expecting undead.
Yes. Yeah.
So I mean,
and of course they did as much as they could to keep themselves from all going through the door together. So it was like I also had to wing some mechanics for this being possible for them to get into the mansion without, being able to report back and say, "Oh, this is what's in there."
Right.
So what I ended up having to do, and this is something that I just came up with on the spot because it was like the rogue said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pop through the door and then pop back out.
Okay.
So I had him pop through the door and the rest of the party saw that he disappeared into shadow inside the doorway. And then I had the rest of the party outside run and I didn't tell him what he saw. So I ran the rest of the, until everybody else went in. So after he went in,
right.
Then the druid said, well, I'm going to run in to make sure he's okay because he can't be in there alone.
Right.
That's crazy. So she ran in and her animal companion ran in. And I had the rest of the party, observe. So the druid runs in and disappears into the shadows right inside the doorway.
Nice.
And so the next two players said, well, I'm going to tie a rope to myself.
Right.
I'm like, oh, great. What am I going to do now? So I had the person with the rope tied around themselves jump through, disappear into shadow, and the rope goes slack.
Nice.
Although there's, what does that? Nothing does that. Nothing teleports you out of a rope.
No, but, the flip side to that is, do you remember the Tomb of Horrors with that open mouth that's actually a Sphere of Annihilation?
Sphere of Annihilation, yes.
So yes, there are things that do that. Yes. It's just a horrible dick move.
The rope went slack, and the person was able to draw it back, and it looked like it had never been tied, but it was complete.
Which is cool, and it gives the mystique of this place is cursed,
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, that was like kind of like, okay, I'm kind of leading the party, and I'm kind of railroading, but I have to get them into the adventure, which I made.
And honestly, it's not a bad thing to kind of give them a boot in every once in a while.
Uh-huh. Well, having them wake up and have four strange objects and not remember 3 days of where they were, that was enough to get them to want to go in, but I had to get them to commit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing. That's why whenever I run Call of Cthulhu, I always play on the character's basic greed.
Mm-hmm.
That always gets them to go in.
I should also mention that I took some advice from a preview copy of a book that I got from Mike Shea of SlyFlourish.com, and it was about how not to over-prepare for games. And I used some of the... They're not really shortcuts. They're just sort of ideas for not focusing your preparation in the wrong ways. And I have to say the advice bore out. Even though it's not D&D, I'd say the book applies across game systems. And it is called The Lazy Dungeon Master. And it has just come out, and hopefully we'll be talking to Mike soon about it.
I'll go check that out after the cast.
Yes, make it so.
I will.
I found some of those ideas very helpful for what I wanted to do, because it was about... I didn't know where the players were going to go.
Right.
And so I couldn't write down every single room. I didn't have a map of the house. I had 3 locations in the house.
You don't really need to have a map of a cursed house, though, because for all they know, part of the curse is that the rooms changed position.
Right.
You know? I mean, what's the point of having a map if it's not ever accurate?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the entire setup of the place is at the whim of the curse binder.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that could well be. I mean, that's not an ability that I had written down. Yeah, so that's just, I guess, once in a while an improv game in a very structured gaming system, I think, is okay, but I don't think I could run many games of Pathfinder in that particular style, because Pathfinder is a structured game.
No, I understand what you're saying with that. I'm just thinking that maybe the mindset should be that rather than think of it as a campaign, think of it as a series of episodes within a season.
Uh-huh.
You know, that might be a way to be able to play it faster and looser within a structured environment like Pathfinder.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got another module to run now. I'm on the second installment of the Adventure Path, and I may well do another interlude in between the two. And what's funny is that in our canned adventure episode, you said that you could not conceive of a campaign run entirely from prepared and published materials.
Yeah, that eventually you as the GM would drive yourself crazy.
And I thought, well, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to run this entire campaign from pre-published. No, I didn't do it.
Nope. See?
Didn't do it.
Told you. it's because those great ideas kind of... I mean, I like the idea of an adventure path. I think that's wonderful that you've got an arc that takes them from level 1 to level 16,
uh-huh.
which is wonderful. But the thing is that your pre-published thing cannot predict what your players are going to do.
That's true. And I'm finding the shortfall in the adventure paths is the players' lives.
Yes.
It's okay, they're walking around in the theme park that is the adventure path.
Right.
But I don't really feel that much in the adventure path addresses the characters.
And that's it. I mean, ultimately, that's what it comes down to. You know, it's by nature, it has to be general enough to be able to include everybody.
Right.
But as a result, it doesn't really include anybody.
That could be. And there are in the player's guides for these adventure paths, there are campaign traits, which supposedly tie you into what's going on with the story.
Okay.
But in the first module, at least half of my party has had their trait resolved, and it no longer has any plot influence.
Wow, 'cause, you know, that's interesting. That's part of, like, the concept of a belief system in Burning Wheel.
Huh.
Because you sit down and you write up 3 beliefs, and that's what the GM uses as the basis of the campaign, essentially. And
okay.
What happens is, over time, you're going to resolve each one of those beliefs, and so you have to write a new one.
Okay.
So so this is taken care of, so this part of this chapter is coming to a close. What, mm-hmm. what do we want to do in the next chapter, you know, that builds off of that old belief, or it could have nothing to do with the old belief. It might be something completely new.
Yeah, in my first in my homebrew that I ran that I started a few years ago, I had all of the players come up with a secret.
Right. Oh, I love those.
Something that they didn't want the rest of the party to know.
The DLS. I always have.
The DLS?
Dirty little secret.
Okay. I tied those secrets into the campaign. And there are still things at 12th level. If I were to pick the game up tomorrow and continue it, there are still things at 12th level that have not been resolved from those secrets, and they are plot hooks for the characters.
Okay.
And I'm finding that this sort of thing is lacking in the adventure path. And I'm only reading the one. I've only read the Legacy of Fire. It could be that later adventure paths do better with this.
Well, it could be also that at each module, it gives you a new campaign. What did you call it? A campaign
trait.
Thank you. It gives you a new set of traits.
Traits are made up at first level, and you get two forever, and they're the two you have forever.
Okay, so that's the problem right there, because if you can resolve the traits early on, you should have the ability to gain other traits.
Well, the trait is, this is a part of your past, this is what you are trying to do, as a result you gain this bonus.
Okay.
And then, you know, even after this is what you're trying to do, even after you've done that, you still have the bonus.
Well, that's well and good, but what I'm saying is that as time goes on, you know, you have, like, say for example, it happens on every odd number module in an adventure path.
Uh-huh.
You can gain another trait from that, and it gives you another bonus once it's resolved, kind of thing. You know? Or it gives you a bonus, and then as it's resolved, that bonus gets to stay with you.
Right.
Or it continues to be grist for more parts of the adventure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I see one of the failings in trying to do that as you just can't, it's so tough to do. It's so tough to be able to bring specific characteristics into a canned adventure in a lot of ways, you know, and when I retconned G1 through 3 for my group in Ithaca, one of the problems that I had going from module to module was the fact that I had to have more and more leeway that wasn't included in the module to keep them in the loop, you know, to keep them interested and moving forward and engaged, you know, because otherwise it's just a bunch of, well, I mean, basically it's a bunch of military incursions other than that, you know.
Right.
Straight up what it is. And if we're going to do that, we might as well play Warhammer or Robotech, you know, what's the BattleTech or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when I mentioned that in Cannery Row, that's kind of what I was basing it on.
Okay.
I couldn't see you sitting there and going, okay, I'm going to start with whatever the equivalent of Keep of the Borderlands is, you know.
Right.
And then work them up through the entire slaver's run or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying people haven't done it. I'm just saying it just doesn't seem engaging and exciting to me.
I didn't do it, so I don't know. I didn't play the modules back then. I've almost always played in homebrews, so I don't know if it's, you know, something that a lot of people did and loved. So
I'm not sure either, because most of the times when we played the modules, they were just designed to be minis or one-shots, you know. Mm-hmm. They were designed to be just their own little self-contained thing that we would play either at gaming club or my friends and I are home for Christmas break. And this is something we can do over Christmas break. You know, we can do 6 to 8 hour marathon sessions and, you know, finish off the module in 2 to 3 sessions kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's just, you know, that's why I was just having trouble. I mean, like I said, I'm sure people have done it and may have even been successful in it, but I can't conceive of it.
Right.
Plus, it seems to take a whole lot out of me, you know. I mean, one of the reasons why I want to do what I do as a GM is because I like, well, I mean, we talked about it in Villainy, I like being the bad guy.
Right.
But I also like to help create a good story. I like to be able to have sessions that, when we're done, if it's only a 90-minute session or if it's a five-hour session, everybody walks away and goes, man, that was fantastic. You know?
Right. I used to over-prepare my stuff. I used to have every single room. I used to have a whole place mapped out. I used to have every single room described. And, you know, every monster had, you know, hit points rolled up. And, you know, it was a lot of work. And, you know, a lot of times it wasn't worth the time that it took. Well, a lot of the time it was like, I wish I had a little more flexibility to run a story here. Whereas, you know, really what I was creating was a theme park.
Yeah, you're creating a Monty Hall most of the time.
Right. Most of the time it was, yeah, because, right. You know, we're talking about my, you know, teens there. So.
Oh, yeah. And plus, you know, there's the old factoid of my friend Brian made this great dungeon, and it only had 7 rooms. And the best part about it was you wanted to look in every room. Uh-huh. Whereas I created a dungeon that had over 30 rooms, and the party made it to about 16 or 17 of them.
Okay.
And that's the dungeon alone, because they managed to find the path to the big bad.
Oh, okay.
And take them out, and they didn't really see the reason of going around and searching other stuff, because the big bad had some of the better, you know, treasure.
Right.
So they were like, whatever, blah, 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 and off they went. So, you know.
So you had done that work for nothing? Is that what you're...
I'm feeling like I did. I mean, I genuinely felt like I did that work for nothing. What I did, kind of as an aside, was once I'd already done that, I didn't really publish it. I made photocopies for some of my friends who were also DMs in case they wanted to run it. My friend Dave ran it out in Colorado for his group. And he threw in a spin that made them have to go from room to room because they had to find pieces to a greater puzzle. And the puzzle turned out to be the statue of this long-lost hero, and once they got all the pieces together, he reanimated.
Okay.
So
that was a different hook than the one you had,
that was
which compelled them to go through everything.
Right, exactly. So I think like that's making that 30-room dungeon, you know, is one of those things that after all these years, because I actually found it, I was going through all of my old notebooks and stuff. I found my dungeon geomorphs, and I found a couple of my AD&D character sheets and stuff like that, and I found that, and I was like, look at this monster. I put in probably close to 20 hours on this thing. And I think and I think we played for about maybe 12.
Well, now I don't feel so bad then.
Yeah.
So I did dwell quite a bit on the game, on preparing for the game. Mm-hmm. I just didn't write everything down.
Which isn't a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, plus your ideas might change as they come up with ideas themselves.
Yeah, and there was a lot that I had to, you know, just make up on the spot.
Great. What a great exercise. Really made you...
If I had written a 30 room dungeon, you know, in this hall, which I had been tempted to do when I initially set out to, you know, when I initially decided I'm going to do Onyx Hall as an interlude, I started looking for maps of manor houses.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Because to me, that was my first step for creating a side dungeon.
Oh, yeah. No, that makes sense.
But that was not the right way to go. That was a waste of my time.
And I concur. I mean, there are some wonderful maps out there.
Oh, yeah. I found a lot of good maps. I found maps to royalty properties.
Right.
A lot of palatial estates in European countries, which, you know, would have been, you know, really nice maps to use.
Oh, yeah.
But completely unnecessary.
Oh, yeah. No, completely.
And
the reason why that was completely unnecessary is because the playground you created was within the domain's walls.
Yes.
And it could be anything.
Yes.
You know, what it had once been, you could have showed them. And then it just stopped mattering because as soon as the Cursebinder took up residence, all those rules and all those things changed.
Yes.
So, I mean, how wonderful that you didn't lock yourself with the albatross around your neck of a map and all these descriptions of all these different rooms.
It was also one of the first Pathfinder games that I had run without using figures on the board.
Ooh, good for you.
So, I mean,
I'm so proud.
I didn't draw a hallway. I didn't, you know, say the monster was here, here, here. I said, this, you know, this is what happens. Oh, and I never actually explained the burning. The stones burning like a pyre.
Oh, right, yeah.
The Cursebinder genie had fire opal jewelry.
And stones burning like a fire. Nice.
Yeah, so they burned with white light, which allowed the which dissolved the bodies of the cursed family.
Oh, nice.
And they were replaced with spirit forms of themselves, and they thanked the person for forgiving them and went on to the next life. If the person said, "Well, no, I don't forgive you. That was a terrible thing you did, you know, having slaves. That was bad.
Mm-hmm.
You should be, you know, suffering forever." Mm-hmm. Well, then the stones were going to burn red, and then the party would witness the cursed family being dragged off to hell.
Nice.
So that was so I had a win condition either way.
Yeah, exactly.
A finish condition either way.
Oh, no, I consider that a win condition either way, because both of those are awesome endings.
Well, they did the soft way. They did the forgiving way.
Which ain't bad. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, like you said, one of the other characters said, you should forgive them. And he said, okay, I forgive you.
Uh-huh.
You know, if that's the way that kind of party dynamic was happening, then that was perfectly within the realm of it, and everything ended the way that it should, and how fantastic, you know?
Yeah, and then, and part of my motivation for making up the story to hook into his history is that of all of the players at the table, he is the hardest to engage in a role-playing sense.
Okay.
He's very much there to play his stats against the module stats.
Ah, gotcha.
And so I have a hard time drawing him out in social encounters. I have a hard time getting him to act beyond, I am a character in a role-playing game.
I gotcha.
So part of, I wanted him to have a more real feeling about his character.
Gotcha.
Like that this trait that he chose before the character was ever played mattered.
Okay.
That it had a defining quality as to who he was.
Fantastic.
And to do that, I bent some rules. And you know what? I don't feel so bad anymore.
Good. Fantastic. I'm glad we've absolved you of the sin.
Yeah, now I'm gonna get all this hate mail on the Paizo board. Like, how could you not follow the... No, I'm not. There's some good conversations over there. And I actually recall one on exactly this kind of thing. It's like, you know, and opinions there were split too.
All right. Hey, fantastic.
I can tell you how else you can tell us your thoughts.
Do tell.
Well, if you, the listener, anyone within the sound of my voice, has any thoughts on the matter, we, that is Peter and I,
yes,
would love to hear them.
I would adore to hear them.
I live to hear your thoughts.
I am so excited about feedback, I can't even find the words for it. I may weep openly.
I'm all verklempt.
I am too.
And in order to give us this feedback, to make us verklempt, you need to email us at rulezeropodcast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. Or
you, yes, or.
Or
yes, please do.
You can email me at pete@rulezeropodcast.com.
Or you can email me at chris@rulezeropodcast.com.
You can always follow us on Twitter and respond to us there.
And you can like us on Facebook and post on our wall. Somehow we've been timelined.
I know. Without even asking us. How dare they?
I know. Harumph. So rude.
Harumph.
But please like us on Facebook. We like to be liked.
Oh, we love to be liked.
Okay. We can go with liked. I wasn't going to go that strong. But, you know, okay. I didn't want to commit.
Okay, fine. You know, I'll commit. I'll commit for both of us.
Okay, we're committed.
Yes, we are.
And we ought to be.
Indeed, we should.
So that is it for me.
And that's it for me.
Yes. So until next episode.
Game on.
Game on. Rule Zero Podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. You can use our podcast in your music video or send us to your friends and family, but be sure to mention our names on our website at www.rulezeropodcast.com. Segment and closing music is by Maggie Sansone, used by permission, and is available at maggiesmusic.com.